Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
And welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Now, coming up on today's show, as Europe continues to ramp up defence spending, we'll be exploring just where that money goes, what threats we need to be most prepared for, and what it all means for the coffers of countries across the continent. We'll be taking you behind the scenes of one of the world's most influential tech companies, Microsoft, and sharing the experiences of women who've helped break barriers, drive change, and redefine what's possible. And plus, given the week that's in it, we'll be taking a look at just how good the Premier League is for the UK economy. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton on LinkedIn, Instagram, X and Facebook. Now, I'm going to start off today with explaining what a dove and a hawk is, not because I've taken a particular interest in nature, but because of a specific meaning in economics. With all of the talk around Governor Adriana Kugler resigning from the Fed board last week and the constant conversation about US interest rates, you're likely to hear whether the Fed wants to take a more dovish or hawkish approach. So a hawk is somebody who prefers to keep monetary policy tight, so they would favour higher interest rates, while a dove prefers it to be looser and they would be more encouraging of an interest rate cut. So as soon as the next Fed decision comes out, which is due in September, or any time you hear this in relation to the ECB, the question to always ask is whether the hawks or the doves win out. Now, across Europe, defence spending is surging to levels not seen in decades. Arms factories are expanding at triple the peacetime rate. EU funding is pouring into ammunition and missile production, and leaders are debating whether to push spending as high as 5% of GDP. But with rising costs, shifting priorities and fears of overspending, is Europe building lasting security or creating new risks? So we're joined now by Declan Power to discuss where the money's going, what it means for Europe's defences and the economic impact this military build-up could have. So first of all, Declan, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you, Susan.
First up, the headline on the front page of the Financial Times at one stage this week was Europe builds for war as arms factories expand at triple speed. Declan, is Europe preparing for war?
I would delete the word war and insert the word deterrent. So, you know, there's an old saying, a Latin saying, sic vi pace parabellum, which means if you want peace, prepare for war. And having been a professional soldier and having spent pretty much most of my professional career in one form or another in dealing with conflict, managing conflict, working within the midst of conflict, I think that Latin phrase actually stands up to scrutiny. We live in a time not just of uncertainty, but, well, actually we do have one certainty. We know that Russia at the moment is going through a period of prolonged bellicosity. And there was a German defence theorist once by the name of Fritz Kramer, who always warned at the height of the Cold War about the dangers of what he called provocative weakness. Europe has been in a state of provocative weakness, but we didn't worry about it because we had the US to backstop us.
But didn't we also have the EU, which was to say that we would always have the collective strength to deal with whatever happened?
Yeah, but that collective strength ultimately has to have some solidity. And when it comes to security, it's like currency. It's like the gold standard, if you like. You know, the paper is only worth the gold you have in the vault, so to speak. Well, your defence ultimately has to be down to some form of big stick, as Teddy Roosevelt, if I can paraphrase him, once put it. And Europe, the European Union didn't really have that. And they didn't worry about it because NATO existed and NATO always had the unquestioned input of the United States. Now we're at a point, and this could actually prove to be a very good thing for Europe, where the European Union, while we're keeping Donald Trump sweet, so to speak, but he is not a reliable partner at this point in time. The US are not filling the role that we might have expected. And Europe has to fill that gap. We primarily have to fill it because Europe is the most important ally to Ukraine, maintaining its sovereignty. And indeed, the other European states, like the Baltics, for example, that exist on the periphery of a very revanchist, irredentist and bellicose player, and that is Russia, who's, you know, tearing up the international rule book. So what it comes down to is this, is that the European Union, and it's not just all about bombs and bullets, but primarily it is, in that they are ramping up their production in order to primarily meet the ammunition needs of Ukraine, but also to ensure that the European Union as a bloc is not a defence lightweight and that it can manage independently of the US.
During the week, Trump said that he may be willing to give security guarantees to the Ukraine as long as it was in a non-NATO environment. As a result of that, do you feel that PESCO now has greater relevance?
Okay, the first bit, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not, anybody that knows my track record, I'm far from anti-American. I'm a big supporter of them as a society and state. At the moment, the US is not a reliable partner. Anything Donald Trump says, I would take with a lorry load of salt. And if defence planners have to go on certainties in as much as they can. The other aspect to Trump's statements with regards to Ukraine is they're very transactional. He sounds more like a small-time mafioso boss wanting to know what's in it for him. So, you know, if the US is going to support Ukraine, it's based on whatever these mineral, rare earth minerals, variations on that theme. But there's nothing solid about boots on the ground in the event of a Russian transgression in the future. There would have to be some worked out deal for the Ukrainians to be able to trust that before they would give up on their desires to join both the European Union and NATO. And thankfully, most of Europe is in agreement with that. You know, there has been a notional argument being made in certain quarters that this war, and it certainly comes from Putin's quarter, that this war happened because of NATO expansion. And people that make that argument, they've been very non-democratic because they're forgetting that the reason NATO expanded wasn't that NATO chiefs sat down and decided we're going in here. The nations that abut Russia made a sovereign choice to want to join European Union and NATO. Why? Because they could see what was coming down the track. And I would argue, had Ukraine been in NATO, we wouldn't be having this war. Because it's very clear, if you transgress against a NATO nation, at least it was anyway up until recently, it's very clear what would happen. Whereas if you're not in the fold, there's grey areas. And Russia has been experimenting. If you've been studying the geopolitical climate for the last number of years, Russia has been experimenting with hybrid warfare to undermine states to try and pull them back into its sphere of influence, the Baltic states in particular. The cyber attack on Tallinn in 2007 is a clear example of that. And when those states became members of both the EU and NATO, they have very small levels of military spending, and their military forces in some cases are even smaller than Ireland's, and that's saying something.
And I do want to get back to a couple of points there.
So security is based on the collective concept.
And I get that, but I do would like your thoughts on PESCO, though.
So the collective concept, I would argue, works. The NATO version of it was pretty much the only game in town. The European Union didn't really look at that. It was based on becoming a political and economic alliance. PESCO arose out of an evolution in affairs that saw the European Union starting to look more at a security and defence architecture based on what was previously a foreign policy and security architecture that saw the birth of what are known as the battle groups, which are now called the European Rapid Deployment Capability. And this was to help manage conflict. There were a whole lot of other instruments created with regards to managing off conflict. And out of that came PESCO. And PESCO, quite simply, is a mechanism within the EU that allows clusters of nations pool their resources to either procure military equipment, to share military equipment, or to take part in particular missions. It's the way the European Union has been evolving militarily has been ideal for a country like Ireland that has its issues about joining something as clear-cut as NATO, for example. It allows a country like ours that needs to have cooperation and to share things, but not to have to sign up to a full-on mutual defence pact. Well, a lot of variation on the theme.
And speaking of pooling resources, like, let's just talk about the sheer amount of this. So the Act in Support of Ammunition Production, ASAP, or ASAP, unveiled in 2023, invested $500 million to tackle specific bottlenecks in production of ammunition and missiles. The EU is now negotiating a new $1.5 billion defence programme that replicates the logic of ASAP through grants and would also fund joint procurement, according to the European Commission. Germany's debt brake doesn't apply to military spending, and all NATO allies have pledged to increase annual defence spending to 5% of GDP within a decade, including 1.5% for strategic infrastructure. Declan, where is all this money coming from?
Well, I'm not going to give you a definitive answer on where it's coming from, but I think we have seen the European Union and bloc, you know, in bloc form, be able to respond to a crisis like it did during the pandemic. This is a crisis. It is a primary resource that needs to be dealt with. There's no point in whinging and saying there's money being diverted for some social services program for defence. If you don't deal with the defence issue, there mightn't be a European Union in existence in 5 to 10 years'
time. But why now? This war is almost heading for 4 years old.
Yeah, but it's not just, this war is an indication of the weakness within Europe. It's not just the war, it's Putin on one side and Trump on the other. It's the infusion of Putin's influence into destabilizing Europe through the war in Ukraine, and it's the lack of American engagement in Europe through Trump's stance and his frankly rather weird bromance that he's having with Putin and that he can't be relied on. So if the European Union, the European Union is backstopping itself in doing this. Now, to come back to a point you made about PESCO, PESCO is just a mechanism. And we need to be clear here. The European Union is not anywhere moving into a territory quite the same as NATO. It's moving into a territory where it's giving the backup to its member state nations to be able to protect themselves to some extent, and to join together as a collective to defend themselves. There's still a lot of work to be done. It's you know, in terms of the money, also the other aspect that you mentioned, some countries need the cash infusion, some don't. Like Ireland doesn't, for example. What we will benefit from in this arrangement is not any free money, so to speak, but being able to cluster with other nations to purchase equipment, because we have a very poor history of procurement. We don't have a culture of it. We've made some poor purchases in the past. We will benefit where if we're buying, just for argument's sake, new helmets and body armour, and we're doing it with the Benelux countries in Germany, or we're doing it with, we'll say, Britain and Belgium, because, you know, PESCO allows for third country participation like the UK or Norway, for example. They have a vast experience of cutting deals and getting procurement that gives you what you need and gives it to you for a good price. So small countries like ours and the Benelux countries and that will benefit in that regard. The other countries, Britain included, that they're looking for access to this tranche of funding, they'll become the engine room for producing the bombs and bullets that are needed to create the deterrent. And this, I want to come back to this point. Without the physical attributes of military force, you don't have the foundation for deterrent. If you do have deterrent, then you avoid war. Deterrent is where your opponent decides it's not simply not worth the hassle of trying to attack you.
Okay. But the problem also with the spending that's going on is that if it is needed in one part of Europe, that the infrastructure physically isn't, like, our motorways aren't built for tanks to be moving between countries. And obviously Ireland being an island nation is separate to that. But there's 17 billion euro to be spent on overhauling the continent's infrastructure to boost military mobility. Mm. Like, are we actually, if the production, sorry, the procurement goes ahead, all of this money is spent on holding what we need to hold, can we move it to where it needs to get to?
In some cases, yes. But you put your finger on something interesting there. Like, for example, the Defence Forces were involved in a major logistics operation earlier this year, where in our commitment to the European Rapid Deployment Capability, we forward moved, you know, we moved a number of vehicles, weapon systems, ammunition into Germany, so that with a small military staff. And that was an overland, oversea operation. It was very efficiently done, and it showed our capacity to be able to manoeuvre accordingly within a timeline. We had to do that up to what a European standard. The European Union used the NATO standard for logistics operations of that nature. Now what's happening, what you're talking about, is that they're upgrading their awareness to ensure that the infrastructure across Europe comes up to a standard that if there is a movement, a need for mass manoeuvre of military forces, that that can be done. Now, the figure you mentioned of 5%, that 5% can include improving your infrastructure to be able to have motorways that can take tanks. In the meantime, everybody benefits because you're improving transport infrastructure anyway.
Well, Giorgia Meloni, the leader of Italy, said this week that a 13.5 billion euro bridge linking Sicily to the mainland is crucial for national security.
In that case, she's probably right, because that particular bridgehead she's talking about has been at the centre of NATO-led manoeuvres in exercises where you're moving large amounts of forces to a perceived area that would be a likely weak point if there was a full-on conventional face-off with the Russians. So what she's doing is, now, there are some who would argue that it's...
trying to sneak a piece of strategic infrastructure investment in under this plan, we could say.
I would be more forgiving of that. I think it's a good... Like, I do think what all countries need to improve in Europe, need to improve their military... They need to examine their military capacity. But your military capacity is more than just bombs and bullets. And it says, as you've pointed out, it's about logistics. It's about being... There's no point in having a brilliant military with weapon systems if you can't manoeuvre them quickly. And I think she's entitled to make the case that that particular bridgehead and the cost it'll take to improve it and maintain it can come out of their budget. The Spanish have made a similar argument, I think, with regards to some aspects of money they want to spend on climate change. And I think you'll see each country will have their own specific things, but that's not unusual. In European military operations, collective military operations, there are things called caveats. So each nation state has its own caveats about what it wants its troops to do, what assets it will provide. And it's more egalitarian than one would think.
And I have to ask you,
sure,
because it would be totally wrong of me not to talk about this during our conversation, and that is the threat of cyber warfare. Because fundamentally, with more and more focus on AI, more and more data being online, is it not more efficient for some countries to conduct cyber warfare rather than physical warfare? And how do we protect against that naturally?
I don't think... the thing about it is warfare is multifaceted. You can't decide, okay, we will just focus on cyber because we really like that and that suits us. You still are at risk of other things. Now, a country like Ireland, we're not likely to be at risk of what they call a full spectrum attack. So the idea of, you know, missiles being fired into Ireland, things would have had to have gone very wrong, and a number of other things would have had to have happened before that would be a likelihood. However, so Ireland DO might want to concentrate on the softer aspects of that might be our contribution. But the reality is we still have to shore up the other things as well. And all countries can bring something to the table, but they still have to ensure that the other areas are covered as well. So a simple example would be, you might have Ireland and a cluster of other countries focus on contributing to cyber defence and security within a European context. But we still have to maintain our air and sea, the integrity of our air and sea security. We're not primarily best placed to do that. So if we're putting money and manpower into cyber defence and security of Europe, maybe we can partner up with somebody else, as we're sort of doing with the UK, whereby air security is primarily looked after by them. So what we're doing now is we're in the process of purchasing a primary radar. We're not going to anytime soon be purchasing fighter jets. There's a lot of things would have to be put in place before we would do that efficiently. But if we know what's coming into our airspace, then we can have proper level of cooperation about who responds to that. So pieces of the jigsaw. Different countries might focus on one piece more than the other, and the collective, through the collective, all pieces of the jigsaw receive cover.
Does that
make sense?
It's intriguing to talk to you, it really is, and there are so many facets to this. I mean, it's a highly emotional topic too for many people listening, I know that, and all that's going on this week. So really appreciate you coming in to talk to us. Thank you very much indeed, Declan Power. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, I'll be joined by the co-author of The Women of Microsoft, Stories of Innovation, a collection of voices from across the company that shine a light on resilience, creativity and the ongoing challenges that women face in tech. So make sure and come back to us for that. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and I'm going to give you an economics trivia quiz now and ask if you can tell from my clues where I was for a couple of days this week. So, the first £1 million deal was done in this city, and the Royal Mint is in this country. Send us in an email at takingstock@newstalk.com if you know, and I'll tell you at the end of the show. Today we're exploring The Women of Microsoft, Stories of Innovation, a collection of voices from across the company that shine a light on resilience, creativity and the ongoing challenges women face in tech. Joining me now is the co-author, Mary Rodriguez. Mary, first of all, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me. I am so excited to have this conversation with you. And for the listeners out there, I think it's going to be a great riveting conversation about women like me, which we're calling the she, as you already know from the book.
I do indeed. You refer to the she quite a lot. And I will tell you, first of all, as I read through the book, Mary, first of all, I really felt that you were talking to me. You often say, come with me into the next chapter and that type of thing. So it's great to actually speak to you now directly. And I felt it was a real feel-good, inspirational book first. It was an insight into Microsoft second, and then a call to action to apply to work their third. But it took me until page 96 before I saw any story in there of anybody who had had a bad experience in the company. There was a story there about somebody who had had a toxic manager, but it took until then to get there. And you are quite open about times the company took a chance on things that didn't work. Like, you reminded me of Microsoft Windows Vista and Clippy.
Yeah.
Clippy as well, the office assistant from 1997.
Clippy.
I did too, actually. So can I ask you to start our conversation today? What have you personally learned from Microsoft that you wanted to share for the readers of this book?
Yeah, that's a great question to get started. I've been at Microsoft for 13 years. I was recruited by Microsoft. So it was actually for me, you know, I was born in Venezuela, Caracas, Venezuela. I went to the States. I migrated to the States when I was 13. And never in my mind would I think I would be working for Microsoft, for big tech, especially for Microsoft. It was not in my remit. It was not in my, you know, in my dreams. Maybe in my dreams, but I thought it was unattainable. And here comes Microsoft and calls me one day, and I obviously say yes. And that really starts a new adventure for me that I had not mapped out for myself. And I say that because for me, when I came in with this idea of an immigrant mindset, a woman, a Latina mindset, and it wasn't, I didn't immediately see it as a platform. What I have learned about Microsoft as a company is that it is absolutely a platform for growth for anyone who wants to see it that way. And Satya, our CEO, Satya Nadella, really drove that message when he came on board a couple of years after I joined. And that really, to me, when I understood that, and I think when women specifically understand that, because we don't have a lot of platforms, it is a huge platform for us to drive ourselves, our legacy. And that's what I have personally done. So to me, the company has been a catalyst for all the things that I have become. Had I not been there, I don't think I would be here today.
As I listen to you there now, I've actually learned more about you there that, as well as what I've heard in the book, which is in so many of the stories, and for readers who will go on to read the book, there's 50 stories to represent 50 years of Microsoft. There was a sense of appreciation of a company like Microsoft taking them on. And yet I thought to myself, with all of the talent that so many of the people had who were writing their stories, I mean, you've chiefs of staff, you've got people who are starting and making various innovations with AI. There was all sorts of things. I was wondering, why didn't the women feel that Microsoft should be grateful to get them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think it's exactly that. It's the idea that once you, I think as women in big tech, because when we entered the industry, it already is, we already have so many things contending against us, so many limitations, so many glass ceilings. The system itself is not built for us. I talk about the book, you know, women that broke their heels on the campus. That was me. I broke three pairs of heels on Microsoft campus, and they were not cheap. And I was so mad. And I was like, somebody didn't think that women would be actually walking these, you know, these floors. Like, who didn't, engineers didn't think that women would be in heels, and that pissed me off, right? So there, I think there's that idea again, to there is appreciation, but there's also the reality that the system is not built for us. So Microsoft is built within the system. So we are still very much fighting against the system. We are being warriors. So that's why you see that juxtaposition of, yes, I'm grateful, but I also understand there's a lot we still need to contend with and contend against in order to drive our legacy.
And that was one of the contrasts that I felt in the book, is that on one hand, Microsoft is such a great company to work in. That was such a theme that carried right through. But also, it's not a panacea either.
And I feel that, you know, that's true in all of tech in big tech as well, and then in every industry, because I talk to women outside of tech, the industry, and you know, when you think about healthcare, public sector, I mean, just anything else, we are contending in many various ways with the same thing, with the same limitations. So it's not just in tech. I think we feel it more because it is innovation. It can be so jarring. We're moving so fast. It is so fast paced, as you talk about Clippy. Things end quickly. Things start quickly, and so you feel that even faster when you're in a company that's leading so much. We're now leading AI, and you can imagine how fast we're moving there. So there's a lot of moving pieces that for people, and especially for women, we have so much intersectionality that it's impacted by that rapid movement. So we're excited about it, but we're also careful, and we come in a little bit like, whoa, what does this mean for me? What does this mean for my career? So there's a lot of that happening, and it's exacerbated by the fast innovation of it.
Well, let's talk about how many of you there are, because you say in the book that as of 2025, there's 57,000 women who work in Microsoft and 72.8% of them are in non-tech roles. But emphatically, over and over, you reiterate again and again that you don't have to have a background in STEM to work in a STEM company. Do you think this misconception truly holds people back?
No, I know it. I have, I've coached women outside of tech for over 20 years about personal branding and their personal stories. And so many, including me, I never thought I didn't actually call myself a woman in tech for years, even though I've been in the industry for that long. I thought, well, if I'm not an engineer, I'm in the industry. And so I never made that correlation in my mind. And I think it's a very woman thing to do, because we want to check off all the boxes before we say who we are fully. And we are fully in tech. And so we are women in tech, and all these roles actually, the company wouldn't exist without these roles, without these support roles of the business verticals. And so a lot of women never have the opportunity to think, well, I'm in comms or I'm in marketing, I'm in sales. And so because I don't know Azure specifically as a product, I may never go sell Azure. And that is not true. And a lot of the women sell themselves short in connecting or even working for companies in tech because of that mentality.
Okay. And I want to understand a bit more though about brand STEM, because you made me reflect a lot in the book, and I get a sense, Mary, that you're a reflector as well. You mentioned about the book, about where women moving as wolves. You remember that, where you picked that up off the counter table in that Airbnb, and that it jolted you out of your chair. And so I get a sense that when you read a book, you go the journey. So I did the same. As I was going through it, I thought to myself, okay, I've co-authored an engineering textbook. I graduated in financial maths and economics. I've been working in STEM initiatives for young people for years, and some are pertinent for women and not all. But yet, over the years, I have yet to come across a time when the brand of STEM is cool. So what is the issue with brand STEM? Why do we still have a problem with all of the time and effort and investment and empowerment and all sorts of things that have been invested in it? Why does it still have a branding issue, do you think?
I think it's because we are still at the very fundamental stage of not including women in the design phase of it. I will give you a simple example. There was an intern. I worked at Microsoft. I led the intern program globally for 3 years. We bring 5,000 interns from all over the world into Seattle for 12 weeks, which is fabulous. And on top of that, we have internship programs across the world. And so it's an incredible opportunity to meet young career builders from everywhere, every university that look at Microsoft as an innovator company, and they want to be part of it. And I spoke to one of these interns, and I could never forget, because I'm not, obviously not into mechanical engineering. So she said, hey, I took a course, and I was excited to become a mechanical engineer. My father, he inspired me to do it, and I just went right into it. And my first class that I take in college, and we're required to wear gear, we're required to wear a uniform. There was nothing that fit me. The outfits that we were supposed to wear and the goggles, there was nothing made for my size. And obviously not for women. And so when you start just at the introduction, at the education level, and women are not considered, the various sizes of women are not considered, it's all one size fits all, which is your regular male size. That to us is an immediate message to that we are not welcome, that we're going to have to fight our way through that. And so the branding fails us there. Yes, we can say from the outside, oh, this is for you. Everybody can be part of STEM. STEM is for everyone. Sure. But when we actually activate on that and we say, okay, I'm inspired, let me go do it, we are usually the only one in the classroom. And if we're not, the three of us are in the classroom, have no gear because nothing was made for us. And so it is, we are, and I always say this all the time, we're the digital, we're the Rosa Parks of the digital age. We have to understand that it's not equitable at all, and it won't be for a while. And if we want to get into those fields, we are in it to not just fight for ourselves in our career. We're here to fight the system until it becomes equitable. And that's not going to be until 134 years per the World Economic Forum stats. And that's dire. You know, that's, we won't see it. And so there's women that I've talked to that will say, I don't want to fight this. It's exhausting. I'm exhausted. I'm just trying to get my career, get a paycheck or whatever. So you have to have impetus. You have to have the inspiration to say, you know what? I'm going to be in it because I love it, and also fight the system while I'm at it.
Well, there's certainly plenty of enthusiasm in that voice that wants to do so anyway, that's for sure. Yeah. I also, from the second element of what I mentioned there, you do give us a lot of insight into what Microsoft, the business, does. Not just the culture, but the actual business and the innovation and so on. You chronicle the journey that Microsoft has been on in terms of four revolutions: personal computing, internet, mobile and cloud. And now we're here with AI. Now, with so many companies automatically set up with Pilot because of the prevalence of Microsoft 365, what do you think is on the short-term horizon for the world when it comes to this?
Yeah, I'm excited. I know I get to be on the sales side right now of Microsoft. I'm in the public sector industry, which covers education. It used to cover healthcare. We just moved that out, but it's education, federal government, and state and local government. And for me, it's really exciting to see how we're having these conversations about our products, M365, Copilot, Azure, in places that mean something specifically to me as a consumer from a citizen perspective. I'll explain. When we create a product and we innovate in, you know, a fire department of an agency in a state, that means that fire department can now do more things that it wasn't able to do at a better time, and therefore save lives. And so that's exciting for me, and I'm seeing that. And for what I love about Microsoft right now is the intent that AI, as a catalyst, as an equalizer, as a driving force, needs to be AI for good and needs to be responsible. And I have to tell you, I would not be at Microsoft. I would not be in any company that I don't align to their mission and know the integrity they have to drive this mission. We know AI is costly, and it's costing not just dollars, but it's or currency. It's costing our environment. It is a thing. And so when I align to a company that knows and understands that and also drives that, but makes sure that we're compensating, that we're making efforts to compensate on the other end, and then I'm aligned to that. It's going to be here, sure. Can we help ourselves? Can we help the planet? Can we make responsible choices with this technology that we're driving? And I see Microsoft driving this as a leader. So it's beyond just creating a product. It is a leader in our environmental and our social impact that we're having.
Mary, you strike me as somebody that knows yourself well. And therefore, it now makes sense why you wrote such a distinct chapter on bias. You call it the bias monster. And yes, you say bias isn't always bad, but bias comes from being born out of old habits, outdated thinking, and fear of failure. And as we wrap up our conversation today, how do we catch ourselves falling foul of these things?
I love this question. Thank you. That's a very, very smart question, I will say, and a very reflective question for me. I think the book really, and if I were to summarize this, just the key threads here, it really is around when you look at bias of yourself, when you look at systems as biases, it's really all around us. We can be biased with ourselves. I have been biased with myself. So for me, it's been this idea of using storytelling as a catalyst in understanding me and understanding myself and understanding my story, how it connects with the broader story of Microsoft as a brand, and then with the broader story of tech, and then with the broader story of the world, meaning we are all connected. And so that to me is important when we talk about that in the book a lot about storytelling, because I am a storyteller. The other one is finding and nurturing, your team, your sponsors, your people that are going to deliver that to you with you, because you don't have all the tools. Some other people may. And that's exciting that we can actually find this in a connected world. Owning your leadership style is the other. Our biases really come from ourselves telling ourselves that we can't, or that I'm too Latin, I'm too loud, I'm too fast. So we become that, and we, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So when we stop and say, okay, what is actually, who am I? And that's okay. This is my style, without shifting that to fit someone else's mold. I think that's going to be, that's major key themes that we explore, and that enables someone like me and the women in the book.
Well, I have to say, you certainly have a very distinct style, as does the book. It absolutely rhymes. Talking to you in person rhymes very much with the book. I would say to anybody who is going to go out and get this, you'll also learn Mary's confidence algorithm as well. I won't ruin that. I will leave that there for anybody who wants to go ahead and figure out how to code that in. And anybody who goes to read it will know exactly what that means. Thank you so much indeed for joining us from Miami, Mary Rodriguez, the co-author of The Women of Microsoft: Stories of Innovation.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, as the Premier League kicks off another year, we'll be diving into the macro and microeconomics of one of the world's biggest sporting juggernauts. Stay with us. You're welcome back here to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, today we're diving into the economics behind one of the world's biggest sports leagues, the Premier League. Joining us is Professor James Reid from the University of Reading, who will shed light on how the league impacts the UK economy, the rise of billionaire owners, and the business of football beyond the pitch. James, first of all, you are very welcome to Taking Stock.
Oh, thank you much for having me.
Well, I'm going to delve straight in with a report that EY had out based on the 2021-22 season. And they said that the Premier League contributed $8 billion to the UK economy. So I did my maths on that because, Professor James, that was the year that the club's revenue was $5.4 billion. So if my maths was right, EY is estimating that for every pound of Premier League club revenue, it contributes £1.50 to the economy. Now, this season, clubs are expected to generate almost $6.8 billion, according to Deloitte. And if I apply that same multiple, this leads to an impact of over £10 billion to the UK economy. So can you talk us through the economics of the Premier League, please?
Well, it's a fascinating thing, isn't it? It absorbs all of our attention for so much of the year. And even when the games aren't on, we still spend a lot of our time looking for the news, latest about who's signing who and who's doing what. And it's massive business, right? You know, you've quoted billions of pounds there, and the television companies decide that they should part with billions of their own pounds to broadcast all that football to us. It's a huge business, and I think, you know, one thing to say is, of course, that. You know, these are numbers, and they're almost, you know, you're putting numbers on things that it's almost impossible really to put numbers on. There's no doubt, no two ways about it, that the Premier League in particular, but football more generally, is part of the fabric of the UK economy.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, in that study as well, it was quoted that around about 0.4% of all the tax take in the UK can be attributed back to the Premier League.
Well, I mean, it's huge business, and there's no doubt, you know, because it attracts our attention. But of course, it also attracts the attention of billionaires around the world, and they're injecting their money into the UK economy. And of course, there's a concern. You know, there's often concerns about the growing foreign ownership in the Premier League and what that means. But fundamentally, these are very wealthy people choosing to invest their money in the UK. And so surely that's a good news story, really.
Well, I think it's also important that we talk about where that money is going, because when you look at the economic footprint of it, the EY estimates that 62.5% of the economic footprint is outside of London. So, for example, in the Northwest, 33,000 jobs are supported with an economic impact of $3.3 billion there. And that number is from a while ago. There wasn't an updated study on it. So from a regional development perspective then, James, is it a case that London has finance and outside London has football?
I mean, football's brilliant from that perspective, right? Because obviously, in almost every other respect, London dominates the UK economy. But when it comes to football, it's the Northwest. That's the global centre of football, you can argue, with most of the Premier League titles since the Premier League began going to the Northwest rather than to London. And undoubtedly as well, you know, you've got very wealthy people now in these parts of the world that wouldn't necessarily otherwise be there. You know, Cheshire, populated by the millionaires of Manchester United, Manchester City, Liverpool, and so on. And again, you can kind of say, well, okay, these are rich footballers, and they're going to send their money back home because often they come from overseas as well. But you know, there's no doubt that these are organisations that wouldn't otherwise exist, and they're thriving and they're drawing people in, tourism, people relocate as well. I talked to lots of my former students, people I talked to who, you know, they chose to live in Manchester and get a job there rather than London because they support Man United. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a wonderful, as you say, counterbalance to the usual centre of geography when it comes to economics in the UK, which is London.
Now, we've spoken about the nice part of the Premier League in terms of revenue, but when we talk about profitability, it's a whole other ballgame. Like, right, because I looked into the P&L, the profit and loss of the various different clubs, right? So let's take Liverpool, right? Last year's winner. In the last financial year, they generated £613 million. Okay, that's what they generated in revenue. They had wage costs of £386 million and ended the season with a pre-tax loss of £62 million. You mentioned Man United there, where it sounds like your students are having an alumni live-in. Man United lost £130 million in that financial year ended 2024. In fact, I had to keep going until I found a name, first of all, that made a profit, but secondly, made a noteworthy profit. And I needed to go as far as Brighton and Hove Albion. Every single club in the Championship, the league below the Premier League, was loss-making on a pre-tax basis. Like, how are these clubs sustainable?
It's a brilliant question. And you can look at another great example of a loss-making yet fabulous enterprise, which is Wrexham, or Welcome to Wrexham. Mm-hmm. They lost £7 million getting out of the fifth division, let alone what they'll do now they've made it to the Championship.
Lose more is what it sounds like, money-wise anyway. That's what it sounds like the formula is.
Well, I mean, to some respect, it boils down to the fact that there are people willing to foot these fantastic losses. You can look into, you know, the ins and outs of why the numbers are what they are. I mean, to some extent, it is because the global consumer is willing to pay for Premier League football. Therefore, the Premier League brings in vast sums of money, and therefore the wage structure, because the footballers are the real assets when it comes to football clubs. These are all the kinds of ins and outs of it. You see people buying a football club making phenomenal losses, you sit there and think, well, what is the explanation? And one is, of course, that they think they can do a Wrexham, where you pick up a team in the fifth division, the fourth division, so you get them to the promised land, and at that point you sell them because someone's willing to pay you some multiple of what you paid for the club 5-6 years ago. But these are, they seem really reckless decisions on the face of it. But on the other hand, football has been loss-making now for decades and decades and even centuries. If you look at the names of enterprises around England, around the UK, 100 years ago and now, the ones that have stayed are primarily football clubs. Football clubs have stayed. They're still there. Manchester United was there 100 years ago. It's here now. So we can say it seems incredibly reckless and unsustainable. Yet here they still are now doing the same thing.
Well, I do wonder, though, is that going to continue based on a development last month? And that is the Football Governance Act. It received royal assent, and that means that an independent football regulator is going to be put in place to make sure a club's custodians are suitable and to protect fans from irresponsible owners. So if the job of this regulator is to establish more of a financial sustainability around these clubs, how do you think that will affect whether it is the division of revenues or simply how clubs are operated?
I mean, to go back to what I was just saying, football clubs have been run badly for over 100 years, and I don't think the existence of a regulator is going to change that. If the distribution of money changes, the Championship teams get a bit more from the Premier League and League One and League Two get a bit more, they'll probably still spend it really badly, because fundamentally, and this is kind of an economics point, is that football clubs are not run on a profit maximisation basis, as we think of as economists. They're run on a win maximisation. And so you're going to keep spending and keep spending, subject to a solvency constraint. And that solvency constraint will usually be, how deep are the pockets of your owners. And so I don't see necessarily the regulator changing the fact that clubs will probably still be, on a kind of an accounting basis, really badly run.
So, but Keir Starmer said this was a watershed moment for the sport. Do you not think that?
I think it is, because it will affect that distribution. I think it will reduce the disparity at the top. You see, because the Premier League broke away 30 years ago to get more of the pie, basically, and that pie has since expanded dramatically. When you've got the Premier League and the Football League, and nowadays the National League as well, coming to the table to discuss the distribution of the revenues, the Premier League says, well, why should we give you any more? We earn all this money. Why should we give you the money so that you can beat us on the pitch? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you've got a regulator saying, well, hang on, guys, if you don't agree, I'm going to decide what the distribution of the revenues is, it's in a sense taking us a little bit back towards the way football was pre-Premier League. And that could be a bit of a, it could be a big culture shock for the Premier League, who have obviously been used to getting it mostly their way now for the last 30 years. But you know, I do think it's a watershed moment. But on the other hand, I do also think that it's a really hard job. You know, there's sort of remit that the regulator has to try and ensure that owners are more responsible. I think that's an incredibly hard job just because of the unique nature of football clubs.
Well, of course, we all know where the money is going, and that is particularly into the pockets of the footballer. So let's just have a look at that, though, because there's a different form of efficiency that I've looked at here. So last year, the average player earned about £300,000 per month. The full wage bill came to £4 billion. Man City then has a wages to revenue ratio of 57%. In other words, that for every £100 they take in revenue, they spend 57% on wages. Spurs, 43%. However, James, Aston Villa's was 93%. Nottingham Forest, 96%. To the point, if our Aston Villa was fined 11 million with that's euro, by the way, with a further 15 million euro conditional on compliance in a 3-year period due to a breach of UEFA's football earnings rule, which is that they have to have a squad cost ratio under 80%. Like, can these types of practices where, like, obviously £300,000 a month is a very, very high figure. It's the speed of the growth of these wages. And naturally enough, what happens in the Premier League is going to drive what happens in the Championship, which is going to drive further on from there. I mean, there's inflation and there's inflation.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the numbers are astronomical, of course. But they reflect the fact that we are, as a global consumer, willing to pay for that product. You know, so the Premier League brings in $6 billion from Sky for UK broadcasting, and many, many more millions from around the world for the global broadcasting rights. And as long as that's there, then those kinds of sums, you know, they can be justified on the basis that that's what these players are worth because they put on that spectacle that we're all willing to pay for.
And I take that point. However, the amount of money, as you say, about half the revenue that the Premier League club makes is from broadcasting. And we could get into the numbers on that, but it's around about that. But TV viewer numbers have flatlined, but instead viewing of sports content grew by 45% in 2024 on YouTube. And like, I see my mother, who is an absolute Man United fan, no matter what happens, and I see her watching the TV, then I see her watching YouTube, watching a commentator who's commentating on the commentating that's happening in the match, and she's watching all of it at the same time. And then she tells me she can't hear me at the same time. Imagine that.
Yeah, I mean, the flatline numbers, that's a really interesting point at the moment, because, of course, you know, the market's only grown for the last 30 years, you know, since the Premier League began, you know, and the TV numbers were big, but not that big. You know, it's always been growing and always been growing, and there's been more, you know, more TV, you know, more matches that can be shown and so on. And the fact that now these numbers are starting to flatline is going to present one of the more interesting, you know, challenges, I think, in the coming years, if that trend carries on, because, you know, all of this spending, all the you know, the buying of football clubs, the, you know, the kind of the welcome to Wrexham kinds of things, they're all predicated on the fact that that pot at the top is continuing to grow and grow at a remarkable rate, you know, higher than inflation kind of rate. Well, so if that changes, it may well unravel an awful lot of what we currently take as given in football.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating topic, James, I have to say. And also, just for those people who will be tuning in to Premier League matches in the coming weeks, like, it started off with, when the Premier League began, there was 60 games. Now they can see 267 games, and more than 1,500 matches are going to be broadcast in the UK this season, including the Premier League, Champions League, English Football League and the FA Cup. So my mother is in safe hands between Sky and YouTube. She'll be fine. So thank you so much indeed for joining me, Professor James Reid from the University of Reading.
Thank you.
Now, I promise to give you the answer to my economics trivia quiz. And so the first £1 million deal was done in the Coal Exchange in Cardiff and the Royal Mint is in Wales. So well done to anybody who got those two clues right. And I want to give a shout out as well to Richard, Sarah and Liv, who are Taking Stock listeners in that beautiful city. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And please share this with people who may be interested in your WhatsApp groups too. Taking Stock is also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock this week was Simon Keane, with Stephen Daunton research. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much indeed for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day, and I look forward to chatting to you again next week.